seen the Gemaras that all addressed the various components of De Masoro. We went through the Agadotas and tried to identify what might be the possible Kiddushim of each story, how it's contributing to the picture. And we ended off with a sugya which really seems to be a contradiction to the whole concept of De Masoro, but significantly the Gemara doesn't identify it as such, and the Gemara doesn't seem to be bothered with the possible challenge to De Masoro from the sugya. And that was the Chiyuv Mechira, the idea that an Ani who has luxurious property, who has things that are more than basic necessities, is obligated in some context to sell them. And it's not clear what that context is, and it's also not clear, and not even really asked, how does that work with the notion that one is obligated to provide for an Ani whatever he is lacking, even if it rises to the level of luxury, assuming certain conditions. So our agenda for today, just to look a little bit at this Gemara and how it's possibly interpreted, how could it be understood in light of De Masoro, and then go through the various approaches to delineating De Masoro, and hopefully put that into some context that we can work with. So ultimately, the Gemara asks the question from a different place, basically from a contradiction in texts, as to whether one is obligated to sell this extra property or not. And the Gemara has this mysterious conclusion, kan kodem giboy, kan laacher giboy, that there's some difference before and after collection. So what does that mean? What does that got to do with anything? So how many approaches did we see in the Rishonim? Essentially five approaches. So what are some of these approaches? How could you possibly look at this question? Give me something. What's some approaches to this question? Right. So what does Rashi say, for example? Right? Nothing?
Or if you collected when you had 200.
Right. So somebody who was
to
give it back. Right. So you collect back. Right. So you collected illegitimately. And Bezdin is going to come and now collect for you, which seems to be some kind of a knas for having collected inappropriately to begin with. Most of the Rishonim did not accept this. And what other approaches do you find? What else is there? Yes, Amir?
So it's supposed to be the idea about whether or not they take the effort of commercial stock or
not. Okay. So what exactly does that mean, right? That's itself interesting. Right, so Tosas really is distinguishing between leket shifu peah and taking from the kupah shel tzedakah. Right, so that's a Tosas quotes Rabbein Tam. It's a question whether Rabbein Tam is the right girsa or some of the Rishonim change it to Rabbein Elchananel. But some Rishon says kodesh shiavu deGiboy shenandotel mikupah shel tzedakah midvarim shenchel hefker kigom leket shifu peah. Meaning the obligatory hefker, not hefker because people just abandon it, but hefker because the Torah makes them abandon it. So that, which is a very significant difference, because hefker by itself could be really the rights to anybody. There's no rules for who can take from normal hefker, that the garbage can outside the base medrash must, that you don't have to be an ani of a certain stature to take anything from the hefker pile. Somebody leaves his lunch on top of that pile, right? Hefker is hefker for everyone. Here, what it means we take from Hefker doesn't mean the Hefker of that. It means the Torah's mandated Hefker of Leket Shifu Peah, which does have a standard who should receive that. And that, you have to be an Ami, you have to be somebody who's poor. So Tosus is saying that this is distinguishing here between that, which apparently we're not going to necessarily make you sell, and somebody who comes to take from Kupa Shel Tzedakah. So what's that distinction about? Just to think about it for a second. It seems to be that it has to do something with defining Ani. But you'd have to be an Ani presumably for either. Right? Presumably to collect from Leket Shifu Peah or to collect from Tzedakah. Right? What's the idea of distinguishing between the status of Inui, status of Ani, in these two contexts? Anybody thought about that? Ellie?
Maybe he's like so poor that even half the stuff isn't enough, so maybe even more.
It means that goes beyond it. And so that you need a higher threshold of poorness. That's interesting. I wonder if that really works that way functionally. So one possible approach, Tamir?
Yeah,
did that Supreme Court, which is about more known, and it's not as Snowy thing much affair, then the thing much affair also be.
You see, it's more public. They said more known. So it's interesting because other Rishonim focus on that,
right?
So you want to maybe put them together, which is possible. Some of the later sources combine some of these views. There's an interesting suggestion in the Birkas Avram. Birkas Avram is a contemporary sefer, and many Masechtas, and the sefer and the Subas as well, which just is intriguing because it may say something about what the whole sugya is about. And he suggests that really there shouldn't be a difference. That there shouldn't be a distinction between Lekit Shechul Be'ah and taking from Staka, except that maybe the Chiyuv Mechira, in the context of Staka, is not really about being qualified in a basic sense to enter into the conversation, but maybe it's about Kedima. Right? Let's say we have to prioritize our Staka. Right? When it comes, it's a very interesting suggestion. I think the reason I'm intrigued by it, again, is not just because it resolves the technical issue here, but because maybe it tells us something about what really the whole Dei Machzoro Sugya is about. That the issue isn't necessarily trying to figure out who qualifies to come into our door. So when you have Lekit Shechul Pe'ah, so it's out there for people to take. That's not really much of a shiloh beyond who is entitled to take it in the first place. But when the Kupa is giving out staka, so as we discussed a little bit yesterday in the Sunday slot, that there is an issue of priority. Right? So what would you do if, let's say, you have two people asking for staka at the same time, and one of them has silver candlesticks and the other one doesn't? So then maybe we should say that if the one who has silver candlesticks wants to get online with the other guy, so then we'll say you got to sell the silver candlesticks. So maybe it's not so much about being entitled at all. It's about getting a space above others when we're ranking. We're giving out staka, and as we've seen, we have to have some kind of system how to prioritize. So maybe within that context, so then you have to have some kind of a cheshbon as to how to decide. So again, that's interesting because it says something about the whole staka division in general. So other Rishonim, like you saw the Rif, right?
Why does that play a distinction within the Mechira?
Because it could be that why do we ask you to sell? We don't ask you to sell because otherwise you're not entitled to take staka. We ask you to sell because otherwise you're not entitled to take staka before the other guy. So that's a very interesting point. It could be that while factoring in who to give staka to first, we could say, listen, if you're able to sell and the other guy isn't able to sell, so then you're going to come after him. But if you want to take from staka and no one else is competing with you, and you want to take from Lekit Shechul Pe'ah, which isn't subject to the same kind of a structure because people just come and take, all right, so you're entitled to take, even if you happen to have assets which are otherwise viewed as luxuries. Okay, so that's a second approach that you find in the Rishonim. A third approach that you find in the Rishonim, right, is in the Rif, and that's also particularly interesting. Right? What does the Rif say? Yes, Menachem?
It says that you don't have to sell when you're taking from the Chidim, but once you take from the Kupa Shel Tzadik, you have to take to sell.
Okay, yes, and that is also very interesting. And that really also possibly gives us some insight into what's going on here. And one of the things, again, to keep in mind, I think we emphasized this last time, but just to re-emphasize it now, is that so we need to figure out, when we look at different approaches to this sugya, so is this sugya somehow coexisting with Dei Machzoro? Is it modifying Dei Machzoro? Is this like an exception to Dei Machzoro? Or somehow is this addressing something else other than Dei Machzoro? So maybe somehow this exists in one universe, and Dei Machzoro exists in a different universe somehow. And we noticed, we mentioned last time, that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch record this halacha in a different section from which they record Dei Machzoro. So the Rif's point that Menachem just mentioned might put this Gemara within a certain specific context. So if we say that it's only relevant to somebody who's asking from the Kupa as opposed to somebody who's asking from individuals, so what does that tell us about the Chiyuv Mechira? Right, it seems to say that, listen, if an individual who has his own, let's say, discretion. Remember, this is something we've been emphasizing on Sundays about the very different decisions that are made by individuals with their own money and those who are empowered with communal money. So maybe we're saying, listen, an individual wants to give, okay, so he doesn't have to distinguish between somebody who happens to have luxurious assets and somebody who doesn't. If he decides that he wants to give to an ani who has gold candlesticks, okay, fine, that's his prerogative. But when dealing with the public kupa, so that's a different story. The public kupa, there is a higher level of responsibility in allocation. Right? Those who are acting on behalf of the communal fund have a different degree of responsibility in how they give out things. And they don't necessarily have the right to give to somebody who could just as easily sell what he has. And by the way, that's a little bit of an oversimplification. I just said just as easily sell. Some of the Rishonim discussed that also one of the issues here might be that when we consider whether or not to force someone to sell, so we're not really sure how successful he'll be in selling what he has, or how successful he'll be in obtaining a different version of what he has. You know, if our whole idea is that he should sell what he has and trade in for something of the next darga, so maybe he won't succeed in getting the next darga. So maybe that's also a part of the practical considerations in terms of how this is put into play in real life. But in any event, maybe we should say that the kupa has certain standards as far as who it gives to, and that's going to be different from the standards of an individual. And that's a very interesting idea, because then what would you say if you want to try to figure out how this could coexist in a De Machzoro universe? How would you address that? You want to address that, Mark?
Would it also depend on whether people know that he's poor?
Which part?
That would affect whether people think he's desperate and would lowball him on the sales of his objects.
I think it's a very interesting idea. I think that once you're wondering if that the concern is practically how easily can he transfer this into something usable, so then that's certainly a practical consideration that's worth considering. But it's also, you know, one of the issues that you're raising is an important issue too. So not only are we wondering will he actually be able to monetize what he has, and will he be able then to take the money and get a lower version that's appropriate, but you also have to ask, sometimes it's not fair, right? That if somebody is very poor, let's say, and he has a house, let's say he happens to have a fancy house. So we could say, listen, we want you to sell the fancy house before taking the staka, but if he's going to do that in a moment of desperation, then he's going to end up having to take a very big cut in terms of what he could otherwise make, and maybe that itself is something we don't want to impose on somebody. So it's not simply comparable to other types of situations where somebody could sustain themselves. Here, the price he'll have to pay in order to sustain himself might be too great, and that may also factor into things. Right? It's also instructive, as some of the Rishonim note, that the Gemara does not say he has to sell a house. Right? A house is included in De Machzoro, giving him some type of a residence, but when listing the things that he's supposed to sell, so the house is actually not included. And as some of the Sfarim point out, because the house is too personal sometimes. So that's also an interesting factor to consider. But if we do want to try to focus on how De Machzoro can coexist with this din, so if you take the Rif's view, so what theory could you formulate then in order to make them coexist? Right? How could you answer the question that De Machzoro, there you got to do, even if it's luxurious, and he's used to it, but here he's apparently used to it because he already has it, and we make him sell it. So how could you reconcile those based on what the Rif says? Right?
De Machzoro also involves how he, his emotional needs.
Right?
So
it's a how come Chovas Mechira doesn't acknowledge his...
So once he already is taken from communal funds and everyone knows that he is a ani, mm-hmm. then that emotional need no longer applies and therefore he has to sell the stuff in order for...
That's interesting. That's a little more creative than I was looking for.
Doesn't the Gemara say that he only sells things that he doesn't really care about, or he doesn't care as much about?
Well, the Gemara is not so explicit about that. It could be that from Yishonim, as we'll see, that might emerge. Which line of the Gemara are you reading saying that exactly? About the Mafrisha, about the...
Wasn't that the whole question about the...
Yeah, so I don't know if the point there is that he doesn't really care about it so much. There's some other possible conclusion to that that we'll get to in a second. But right now, to focus on the other answer, seems to be an alternative track to that answer. So if we're focusing on that answer, what possible could it be? The point of that Maharisha, I'm not sure if it's that he doesn't care about it. I think there's a different point to that answer. So we'll have to...
the whole implication that you might have to sell your meat and other things,
mm-hmm.
since you don't necessarily distinguish between fancy bed and not fancy bed, but you do distinguish between fancy kelim and not fancy kelim. So the Gemara says, no, someone who cares about fancy kelim also cares, right? But then it said, no, but not Maharisha,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't distinguish.
Right, so I don't know if the point of that is that he himself doesn't care. I think there might be a different point. You might be right that that's one. I think, though, the way the Rishonim seems to interpret it is that it's focusing on a different aspect of it. But either way, that seems to be a different answer in the Gemara. So let's first talk about this, then come back to that, because there are important dinim that will emerge from that. But if you say this distinction of Giboy and not Giboy, and the Rif, so you know what is emerging from there, I think, is the following. Right? That if the Rif says that, oh, this halach of Mechira only applies on the Kupa level, not on the Achid level, so it leaves room for a conclusion as follows. You could say, who's De Machsaro addressed to? De Machsaro is addressed to the individual. The individual is supposed to worry about somebody's emotional needs, somebody's more extreme needs, to such an extent that he'll do whatever it takes. But the Kupa maybe doesn't have that kind of latitude. The Kupa has to be more balanced. And has to be more discriminating with communal funds. And therefore, they aren't able to give out so generously. And they're going to have to also insist that you sell something that you have if it's over the top. So that's a very interesting distinction, especially because we'll see that maybe we find the opposite distinction in Poskim. So that we'll hopefully get to in a few minutes. But either way, that's theoretically a very interesting distinction, which could allow for some space to exist on the one hand for the Chovas Mechira, and on the other hand for De Machzor. So then there's a fourth and fifth approach in the Rishonim also, which we won't focus on as much. You know, the opposite approaches that you find in the Shilta Gibarim and the Ritva about whether you had this extra property before you collected, whether you got the extra property after you collected. So that's another way also to interpret this line. So what other possible ways are there to address, in general, the stiras that we find within the sugya between De Machzoro and cases where you don't go all out? Including the Chovas HaMechira, right? So the Chovas HaMechira is coming at the end of a whole Amud where we find some situations where you give very liberally and some situations where you don't. So including this, and we'll get to Menachem's point in a minute, so what other possible approaches do you find? What other possible distinctions, rules for when you say De Machzoro and when you don't say De Machzoro? What do some of the Rishonim say? What else could you suggest? Right, some of them we've discussed already. So one approach is that you only say De Machzoro if somebody comes from a background where they had these luxuries, but not somebody who's just looking for them fresh, but doesn't have a whole history of being accustomed to them. Right? That was something that a number of the Rishonim had mentioned. I saw Talmid Rabbeinu Yonah and the Shituk HaMetzah said this. Right? We saw that the Maharsha emphasized that's why the language of the Gemara appears a few times, Ani Ben Tovin, right? Specifically somebody who has a ancestry of wealth, so he's used to these things, but not simply somebody who wants it. We also saw that the Meiri, who says a number of different points here, but the Meiri also says that if somebody legitimately became used to something, not because he has a background of wealth, but because he indulged more than he should have, so he developed a taste for something that wouldn't have been regularly coming to him. So then there's no obligation of De Machzor. I saw one contemporary tshuva that talked about, let's say somebody was poor, and then he got a job, and he started making a living, and part of what he needed to do for his job was he needed a car. He didn't have a car when he was not working, but he didn't really felt he needed one. And then while he was working, he needed a car, and then he lost his job. So now he can't afford a car anymore, so he was discussing, do you have an obligation? It's one of the Sfarim Hilchos Tzedakah was talking about the Shaila. So do you have an obligation to provide this person with a car? Do you say, De Machzoro? So the author of this tshuva was noting that, well, he is used to it. He is in the category of De Machzoro. This is part of his lifestyle to have a car. And it's not his fault that he became used to it. He didn't decide to indulge in something he couldn't afford. When he got used to the car, it was because he had a job that required having a car. So it was normal and expected that he'd become accustomed to having a car. So that, this author thought, should be considered legitimate De Machzoro. But it's an example of this kind of analysis that the Meiri is saying that if somebody decided to indulge where it wasn't really reasonable, so then we don't extend De Machzoro to that individual. But if it was reasonable for him to become used to it because that was his family history, or in that case, some other reason, because he had a job which made that a part of his lifestyle, and now he no longer has that job, but it was reasonable at the time, so then that also enters into the category of De Machzoro. Tamir?
You could also say that De Machzoro could apply not necessarily to the person, but to the objects in which he's trying to attain or get back.
Okay, expand on that. How would that
if it's an object that he, let's say, uses more often or something that he needs, then that might fall under De Machzoro more than an object which is more just for, it's nice, but it's like decorated purpose or it was just something that was not as needed.
Okay, so I think there is a distinction somewhere along those lines. I think I have to say it a little bit differently, but I think it's also similar to what Menachem was emphasizing about the Maharisha. So we'll come back to that point also in a few minutes. There is something, I don't know if it's exactly formulated, maybe it's close to that. We'll come back to that in a minute. Akiva?
The point that you said that person needs a car to get a job, maybe that there's this article I once read in which this person described their mother growing up and when they were like very poor. That part of what enabled her to get jobs was the fact that she had just this one very nice dress that when she went to a job interview was able to use that, was able to come across as somebody who was better off than the necessary. Or the point of the article was that when you see like poor people buying things they can't necessarily afford, it's not necessarily dumb. So that might be an interesting application of the De Machzoro. It might be that in order for them to obtain any prestige that they used to have, they need to have the trappings of wealth that they previously had.
That is a very real element which you find here, and you also find that elsewhere. You find that in Gemaras and Bava Metzia, right? There are explicit Gemaras and Bava Metzia which talk about different reasons why you might borrow property from somebody. And one of the reasons why you might borrow property is because you need sometimes to look like you have the property in order to be able to go further in your business dealings. So that itself, there is a very real component, which you hear advice about all the time, which is its own separate category. I think there's no question that that's also an element of De Machzoro. It has all kinds of different dimensions to it, you know, how it imbues the individual with dignity and confidence, how it helps them to address other people, how it covers up whatever issues they may have had that may be holding them back. There's no question, a lot of truth to that, and that's also something that the Meiri emphasized. The Meiri, again, says all kinds of interesting things always and here. So here the Meiri also says about the Eved Larutz Lefanav, about the idea of having the Eved go in front of him, that was only specifically when somebody was traveling from one town to the next and needed to be able to hold a certain stature as he goes into the other town, maybe that's why he should have the Eved going in front of him. So there's no question there are a lot of aspects to what Akiva is mentioning. But this tshuva that I was bringing up here happens to also emphasize something else. he was focusing on the fact that when this person did have a job, that he got used to having a car, and therefore that sense of being accustomed to something came from a legitimate place, as opposed to somebody who indulged in something outside of his means, and then now says to the community, now you have to support me on this level, so then maybe he wouldn't say de machzaro, but if it came from the family history, or what this tshuva is adding, it came from reasonable, understandable developments later on in life, so then that's within the category of de machzaro. There is another point that Rishonim also bring up, which some of the guys mentioned last week. Remember the position of the Gaonim that the Shita Mekubetzis quotes, right? What does the Gaonim say? The Gaonim say that you only have De Machzaro when it's not known that he is indigent, that he needs money, and this is a way of kind of protecting him from having to have that embarrassment, having to have that sense of yirida. So that's a very interesting view. It's just also worth noting that halacha lemaisa, the Derech Amuna, if you're familiar with the Sefer Derech Amuna is one of the Sfarim of Reb Chaim Kanievsky. If you're familiar with his writing schedule, Reb Chaim Kanievsky goes through Kol Torah Kula every year. He has a system where he has everything, a little more than Daf Yomi, and he goes through Kol Torah Kula every year, and then if it's a leap year, so he has an extra month. So in the extra month, he writes a Sefer. So at least that's how it used to be, from many years ago. So while he was writing Derech Amuna is, he's written volumes on the Yerushalmi, he's written other stuff. Nowadays, it's very popular for other people to print Sfarim with Psalchim with Kantinevsky, since it'll be the new invoked thing to do, to publish a paper, and he also puts Psalchim from Reb Chaim Kanievsky. But the Sfarim that Reb Chaim Kanievsky himself writes are a different style. So he's written Biurim on the Yerushalmi, he's written Biurim on the Rambam and Zoraim. So there is a volume, a couple of volumes called Derech Amuna. Wrote on the Sechtes Kitanas and Hochtes Tzitzis and film and things like that. So one of the Sfarim he has is on the Rambam in Zoraim. So the Rambam in Hochtes Matnas Anirim is a volume called the Derech Amuna. And the Derech Amuna is written like in the style of the Mishnah Berurah. He has Psak, he has Makoros all on the Rambam. So he writes that this distinction that the Shita Mekubetzis has, that it only is there in order to protect somebody from being exposed as a needy individual. Right, practically speaking, the poskim have not recorded this distinction. This is not a distinction that you find incorporated into halacha lemaisa. It may be true in theory, or maybe a concept you find in the Rishonim. It's not something that we find practically laid out. Okay, what other possible distinctions do we have? There is an interesting comment that Rav Vosner emphasizes in his Tshuvas, in the Tshuvas Shevet Halevi. He also quotes from the Meiri. I didn't actually notice this in the Meiri in our daf book again, but he quotes this from the Meiri. Again, the Meiri is an endless source of fascinating things, but we had experienced that a couple times already this week. But the Meiri is a big gaon in general, and you have many fascinating things to say. But as you may know, so the Meiri was unavailable to the Jewish world for many centuries. He was davening in the Vatican Minyan. He was in the Vatican for many hundreds of years, and only very recently was the Meiri discovered. So one of the things that you find in the Meiri is that a lot of the Achronish Svaras, a lot of the things that have been well known from the Achronim was actually said earlier by the Meiri. So we mentioned one yesterday, we talked about his position on Meir Yerche Kodmin, which had been attributed to later sources for many centuries. So there's many fascinating things in the Meiri. So Rav Vosner quotes from the Meiri that the whole idea of De Machzaro is, especially in light of the beginning part of our Gemara here, that the Gemara says, Atapas HaMazayim Ebeiz, Ata Metzuva Olav LaFarnaso, V'Ata Metzuva Olav LaAshro, right, that there's a limit, that De Machzaro is specifically about what he is missing, and not about enriching him to a degree that he wasn't there before. So says the Meiri that the purpose of De Machzaro is we don't want this person to have tainas on God because of his misfortune. Shlo Yisroim al Gorolo. We don't want him to have a crisis because of this lot that has been his. the fact that he used to have something and has lost it. So in order to save him from that, whether it's something to do with our concern for his own personal state, whether it's because of the effect this will have on others, it's not 100% clear, but that's how he understands it, that Tei Machsaro is directed towards that, that somebody who used to have something and has lost it, and therefore is going to have tainas on God because he doesn't have what he had used to have. So our obligation is to try to forestall that, to try to compensate for this taina by providing him with what he used to have. Hi.
But isn't that person anytime going to have tainas that he can't support himself like he used to support himself, regardless of whether he still has the same toys to play with?
Well, the toys are hopefully including the fact that he can't do it himself.
Yeah.
That he has to have other people do it.
He has to rely upon others. That's
maybe. I guess that's also a question that goes a little bit more deeply, that the extent to which somebody distinguishes between being able to do it themselves and taking it from others. Yes, it's true that that is a part of human nature. Some of the Bali Musa write that that's the whole point of the world, right? The whole reason that God created the world is because before the world was created, so all the neshamos were benefiting from God's presence without having done anything to earn it themselves. So God created a world where we could have schar, where we could earn our own bread, so to speak, in contrast to the phrases nahama de kisufa, that we shouldn't take the bread of embarrassment, we shouldn't be just given a handout by God. So, yes, it's true that does go to one of the fundamental aspects of human nature, that we'd much rather have our ability to support ourselves than have somebody else. So, yeah, it's true, that's harder to negate. That doesn't seem to be in the capacity of other people to address, except to the extent that it could. You know, the extent, and clearly, as the Rambam is going to say in his levels, that the highest level of stock is providing somebody with the ability to support themselves. So it's a little bit up to the rest of society to address that concern to the fullest degree possible, which is also what Akiva was saying, that if you give somebody the ability to get a job because of a nice dress, because of a nice car, so then that's also going to certainly factor into the broader picture of Dei Machsaro, and maybe even more so. Hi.
If, according to this, if someone expresses complete faith in God, Gamzu Latova, etc., would Dei Machsaro still apply to him?
Well, part of it is that we see, I don't know exactly how to categorize what you're describing, but part of what we saw last week when looking at some of these Gemaras is that there seems to be somewhat of a tension between giving him whatever he's missing and also trying to nudge him to a place where he doesn't necessarily feel like he needs it so much. So I don't know if you're describing a situation where somebody on the one hand is miserable because he doesn't have something, but at the same time is saying it's okay, I'm going to cobble everything ba'ava. That's probably somewhat of a contradiction. Probably to whatever extent somebody would be saying what you're describing, they probably have adjusted and don't really feel that they need it so much. I think theoretically you could create a space where somebody's saying both things, and then it'd be interesting to try to analyze how it plays out, but probably they go hand in hand to some degree. Nachum?
Is there a mitzvah of tzedakah when the person is announcing?
So that's also a question. Now, we discussed a little bit the question of whether there is a mitzvah of tzedakah in terms of the prohibitions, in terms of where the lavin apply without a tviyah, that the Rashba quoted a view that there's only the lavin of los amitz and los sikbos if the person is asking, although it sounds like from the Rambam that it applies even if he's not asking. And then if the question is, if he's not only not asking, but he feels he doesn't need it, or he declines it, so a little bit, that's some of the lines in our Gemara that we saw here, about using a matana, a halva, so that we're going to get into a little bit more. We're going to come back to those points, but it seems like some of those issues are addressed a little bit by our Gemara. Depending on what you're talking about a lack of a tvi, or you're talking about a refusal to take it, you're talking about a refusal to the ani to acknowledge, there's a couple different levels of him not asking.
Well, let's say, like, the difference, when we're referring to Dei Machsaro, right, that seems to indicate going beyond
right. The
basic needs. So assuming that a person was wealthy, but is still in a position, a lower position, but still a position where they have their basic needs, and they're not asking for things from people to restore them to their original position. So there would seem to be, in that case, like no need of giving, right?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, they may not be feeling it, you know, because the extent to which it seems to be that Dei Machsaro is about the emotional reality. So if they used to have a limousine and now they have a normal car, but they're getting along fine. It sounds like from our whole path of De Machzara from the Gemara that even though they have less than they used to have, but if they're not feeling the chisaron, if they're not experiencing emotional anguish because of that chisaron, then maybe that's not in this category. That's what it seems like, just kind of impressionistically. So those are some of the distinctions that you find in the Rishonim in general to address when De Machzara does apply and when it seems not to apply in some of these lines. And that would also cover, perhaps, the Chovas Mechira at the end. But just to mention two other points which could perhaps also address the Chovas Mechira point. One other approach is also that if we saw that De Machzara was really about the transition, it's about some kind of a temporary sustenance while easing somebody into a different standard of life, and it's not meant to last forever. So the truth is, the Chovas Mechira could actually be consistent with that, because if we read the Gemara a little bit more carefully, right, the Gemara doesn't actually say that he shouldn't have any type of luxury, right? What does the Gemara say? Right, how yimishdamesh plays off, yishdamesh b'play kesef. B'kesef yishdamesh b'play nechoshes. So what does that mean? How would you understand the direction of that Gemara? Right, it's not really saying he shouldn't have anything more than the bare minimum. What's it saying? Right, it seems like, I think Sammy and Adina are saying the same thing at the same time. Right, that basically it's kind of about transitioning him also. Right, that maybe this is in the spirit of De Machzara, maybe it's not a contradiction, that maybe De Machzara is about making this transition easier, and saying you shouldn't drop from riches to bankruptcy in one fell swoop, but you should have some accompaniment along the way, you should be accompanied so that you're not going to feel it in such a acute fashion. So too, here the Gemara is saying something maybe not contradictory, maybe in line with that, that if somebody is taking from Staka and he happens to have a lot of luxuries, we tell them, listen, you know, you're on your way down here. We don't say it like that, but we say that things are going to be easier for you emotionally if, and it's more than that clearly, because we're requiring to do that as part of the Staka receiving process, but we're saying that, listen, instead of having solid gold candlesticks, you should have silver candlesticks. Silver candlesticks are still more than the bare necessity, but it's a way of saying that, listen, we are helping you slowly adjust to a lower standard of living. So it's possible that this is very much in the spirit of De Machzara instead of something that contradicts it. But there is another approach also, and this is what Menachem was alluding to before with the other answer in the Gemara about the Machrisha, and this possibly is also alluded to by Tosfos in the top of the page, and it's probably also alluded to by the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi, in contrast to the Bavli, the Yerushalmi seems to more explicitly be asking about the Chovas Mechira against the De Machzara principle. And what approach do you see, let's say, from all of those, in one way or another? That there are different things that are subject to different standards. De Machzara only applies to certain types of items. And other types of items are not in that category. Certain things, no matter how luxurious they are, can qualify for De Machzara, while other things are simply not subject to that standard. So this could be what Tosfos is getting at, right? Tosfos in the top of the page, Plikasa Plizal, right? So says Tosfos, Aha Deloy Afinu B'Shadrinu Klamar Ukva Deloyel. And we saw in the previous case that Marukva heard that the honor he was giving to was drinking fancy wine, was used to a high standard of luxury, so instead of stopping the staka, he said, double it. So how come in this case we don't say double it? Mishum t'bahanach t'varev lo shayya k'fino. Ela vaday osher haya. That these things, we don't have a concept of mefunuk. That somebody can't be so sensitive, so refined, that they feel pain without having these things. So what is Tosfos getting at? Tosfos is clearly not saying the full distinction, but is opening the door to something. Right? Tosfos is saying some kind of distinction, not saying what it is, but there's some kind of distinction in terms of the materials we're talking about. Right? All the other distinctions we've seen so far about Ani Ben Tovim or somebody who was not actually ever rich. Right? So those were about the Ani himself, about whether or not he qualifies for De Machzara. Then we saw some Rishonim who are distinguishing based on what types of situations get de machzorim and which don't. This Tosfos is distinguishing on a different level. It's distinguishing between certain items, you know, food stamps you can only use to buy food. Certain items qualify for government assistance and certain items don't. So certain items qualify for de machzorim and some don't. So what is the distinction? So some have a distinction, some assume this is what Tosfos is getting at, and this is almost explicit in the Yerushalmi, if you got a chance to see that, I think it was on the Makaros last week, that it has to do with things that are really used personally. Like food certainly qualifies. We call a hanas haguf, something which gives direct benefit to the individual. So that's in this category. While something which is less directly used by the body, so then that's not in this category. So it would seem like having a fancy painting on the wall, something like that, the idea that somebody likes luxuries, maybe that might never really enter into de machzoro, according to some positions in the Rishon. But that de machzoro means that in the way that you actually function, so you have developed a certain sensitivity, a certain higher level of sensitivity than other people, but that's become your standard now and how you actually function and what you eat and how you eat, maybe in how you dress and things like that. But things that are completely external to you are never going to qualify for de machzoro in that category. And maybe that's what this machrisha is. So maybe that's one answer in the Gemara. Maybe that's Tosfos. Maybe that's the Rishalmi. That might be another path here in terms of the whole de machzoro story. Hi.
Is Tosfos referring to the case of where they're spraying like that fancy wine? Is that
the that's the case where he does double it.
Right, that's the case where he did double it. So Tosfos is making a distinction between that case and having gold and silver?
Yeah, because it seems like the wine, that's a part of what he consumes. So something that's direct hanas aguf, even if it's very extreme luxury hanas aguf, so that could rise to the level of de machzoro. Well, these things are external. Now, this Tosfos is not yet talking about, well, I guess it kind of is getting to the Chovas Mechira Sugya, so that would also allow for that type of distinction to be made within that Sugya. So all of these give us some possible ways to categorize De Machzoro, to understand how different dinim could play off against it. What's very interesting is Halacha L'maisa. So you find a machlokes about the very important point about De Machzoro in the poskim, once you get past the Rishonim, and it may actually be the opposite of one of the things that we said a few minutes ago. Right? When the poskim talking about from the level of the Ramah and the Nosekeim and the Shulchan Aruch, in terms of De Machzoro as a whole, who does De Machzoro address? And one of the questions, which we'll talk about separately, but one of the questions that is part of the issue, and the Achronim struggle with this, is that our Gemara also tells us, and we'll look at this in a little bit more detail, that there is an upper limit to how much tzedakah you're expected to give. Right? What's that upper limit? A fifth, 20%. Right? Mevazvez al yevazvez ilsim mechomish. So practically speaking, how is it ever going to work out that you are going to provide de machzoro to aniyim and also stay within a one-fifth limit? Now, one answer you could give is, well, it doesn't have to work out. De machzoro represents that which is potential tzedakah, while the limit represents how much you can actually dole out. So if you have enough to dole out forever, so then we have to know what is potential tzedakah to be worthy of receiving anything. But in a chanami, you're not going to be able to fill up the whole needing list, so that's what you have the limit of one-fifth for. But despite that possible approach, so there is a general tension which the earlier sources and later sources try to figure out. It seems to be that we have two different worlds here. On the one hand, oh, give the guy an evid arutz lefanav, and on the other hand, make sure not to spend more than a fifth. It seems like there's a tension between those two ideas, I think.
So we saw in like the Ramah and other Rishonim, so speak about how it's more of a communal but then the Rambam, based on the Lashon of the Rambam, he just says that Tam too, like Tam too. So it seems to me like unclear whether he would the Rambam would say that it's an individual obligation, not a communal obligation, in which case it would be at odds with the 1/5 limit.
Okay, very good. So that is what I was looking for, right? That essentially you see that, and again, in terms of the actual steer between the 1/5 and this, I think there are ways to address it, but nonetheless, certainly use attention that the Svarim are feeling. So that machlok is exactly what I was looking for, that there are those, such as the Rama, who maintain that De Machsoro is never addressed to the individual. De Machsoro is a statement to the community, that the community is obligated to try to fill everything that's lacking of the ani, but every individual on his own has a limit to what he's expected to give, and that limit is the 1/5 limit. So this idea that the Rambam has, whether or not the Rambam can be read in sync with that, and your point is well taken, it's a big question, but this was, in general, a machlokas on the side of the page. Right? The Bach on the side of the page of the tour assumes that it's a chovas hayochid. And he brings a raya that it's a chovas hayochid from who?
Hillel,
right? That look, Hillel took it upon himself to run in front of the ani. So maybe that shows you that it's a chovas hayochid. And the Gra agrees with him. But the Rama and the Shach and many others take the view that it is a chovas hayachid, a chovas hatzibur rather, and Rav Osner, in a different tshuva, Rav Osner writes that even though there are those who disagree with the Rama, but Metzias paskins like the Rama. Just practically speaking, there's no way to assign de machsoro to any individual and to expect that to be possible. So in terms of the real world, we can only accommodate a theoretical, even a theoretical de machsoro, by seeing it as a communal obligation. So this is fascinating on a couple of levels. Right, first of all, it's kind of the opposite of what we said a few minutes ago with the Rif. Right? The Rif's distinction seems to be that the Rif wasn't saying it's befeirish, but what we were trying to read into the Rif is that an individual is going to give de machzoro, but that the chovas mechira comes up when the kupa, when the public, is called on to address this person. Well, here we're kind of making the feel the other way, that de machzoro is only going to be applicable to the community, and the individual doesn't necessarily have this obligation. So that's itself interesting. It is possible to define Sibur a little bit differently, and saying that you could maybe make the Rif the way, even though the Rif wasn't addressing the point explicitly anyway, but it's possible to maybe make the two things we just said not be such a contradiction. You could say that the Rif is talking about the Kupa Shel Tzedaka, the official fund that is on behalf of the community, which has strict rules of objectivity in terms of how it's given out, and you have to worry about whether you are prioritizing people properly. So then we could say, okay, that you don't really have de machzoro in that sense. But we do have de machzoro outside of the kupa on the individual, but it's not an obligation on any one individual. That it's an obligation on the tzibor of individuals, that all the individuals together should be worrying about de machzoro. So we could theoretically accommodate all these points, right? We could say that the kupa has the highest responsibility of discrimination. The individual doesn't have that same responsibility to worry about whether or not this ani is completely unable to get money anywhere else. But the de machsoro, that's really on the group of individuals. That's on society as a whole. You can't say that any one individual has an obligation to go all the way up to de machsoro. But that hopefully, between everybody worrying about him, we'll get to de machsoro. Which, as the Shach points out, could also accommodate the Hillel Raya also. You could say that, yes, Hillel would also agree that it's not his personal responsibility, it's the Tzibor's responsibility, but there was nobody else that was going to do this. So he knew that the Tzibor wasn't stepping up, or there wasn't enough in the Tzibor to live up to it, so therefore he had to get involved personally. Now, does this perhaps tie in any way to our question of a halachta bedracha versus v'yahav t'lerecha kamocha. How is Deimach, I'm not sure if it's a straight answer, but it's kind of throwing this question out. How does Deimach Saro correlate? Does Deimach Saro correlate to one of those more than the other? All right.
It seems that halachta bedracha, Deimach Saro is like this much further than regular just helping out somebody. Halachta bedracha, it's you're trying to be much further than how you normally help out other people, which would be after learning to come off and act like God. Be improving the divine self by going further than what is normally necessary for the individual.
All right, I tend to be sympathetic to that position. I don't know if it's 100% mukhrach. I think, you know, if I had to guess, I think I would say something more along those lines, that what we saw from the Gemara in Sukkah, right, that the schar of tzedakah comes from the chesed shebo, comes from the degree to which you feel the giving and the rachmanis towards the person. So we could say that, listen, as far as a base level, v'yahav t'lerecha kamocha, then we go on real needs, we go on actual nitzrach. But in terms of sensitivity, in terms of the divine personality that we're trying to cultivate, so we want you not only to provide for demonstrable needs, but we want you also to connect to the individual suffering that the person is going through, and that's where Deimach Saro actually fully realizes itself. So that perhaps would work a little bit better with how we understood the Rif. Right? That the idea is that the Tzibur as a whole, from the Kupa, so from the Kupa we focus more on really the V'yahav t'lerecha kamocha component. And the fact that you're used to gold silverware, that's not really the Tzibur's issue. But from an individual level, so then we extend it to Deimach Saro, you should have compassion for how this person is emotionally suffering. And it's appropriate for the individual to try to accommodate that. And then this view of Deimach Saro being not about the individual, but the Tzibur, so again, we could say that really it's about the Rachmanis of the Tzibur, but no one person by himself can be expected to carry this burden. Just practically, like Rav Osner said in the Ramah, that the Metzias backs up the Ramah. No one person can be expected to shoulder this by himself. So as far as seeing Deimach Saro not only as a possibility, but as an obligation, that goes in the Tzibur. Now, what do I mean by the last point of a possibility rather than obligation? So just to clarify that point, there are really two chidushim in Deimach Saro. Now, what are the two chidushim? Right, Deimach Saro, the whole halacha of Deimach Saro could be telling me two things that are not obvious. What are they? Are you?
That needs include more than just food and basic needs.
Yes, okay, that's actually both of them, but so sharpen that point. So what do you mean by that? That sentence also includes two chidushim.
That there's more to poor people than just...
Okay, so that also, I have to help you out here. You're saying, everything you're saying is true, but what I'm looking for is that the chiddush is that you could have thought that I'm not obligated to give things beyond basic food and water and like that. Okay, so that's already one chiddush. But there's another chiddush here, that even if you agree, let's say we all agree that you're not obligated to do these things, I might say that I'm not allowed to do these things. Right? That if I'm giving tzedakah, so we see, and that's what also emerges from our Gemara here, from many lines in our Gemara, that there is a responsibility that comes with giving tzedakah. So it's not enough, the fact that you're generous and the fact that you want to give your money away, that's terrific, but that's not the whole mitzvah. Right? There's also a responsibility to give the money in places where it's actually accomplishing tzedakah. So maybe you might say that, let's say I feel bad, Nebuch, this guy used to be rich, and now he's making it, he's surviving, but he feels a lot of emotional pain on how he's not living at the same standard that he used to have. So I feel bad for him, I want to help him out. Maybe we'll say, so why do you feel bad for him? But that's not a fair use of your tzedakah, of your miser money, of something that you want to take a tax deduction for, spiritually speaking. Right? That's not fair. You have to give to the oni. What right do you have to use this money that you're calling tzedakah and give it just to fulfill the emotional need of somebody who's able to eat and drink and sleep in a warm bed What right do you have to give the money to him? Right? So you need a heter, really, from De Machzor. You need to be told not only that maybe you should, but that you're allowed to give to this person. So really, there's two chidushim of De Machzor. That this is a legitimate source of staka, or legitimate recipient of staka. And then the chidush that goes further, that actually it could become an obligation of you to provide this staka. So within that, you could distinguish between the two dinin and say that the individual has an option of de machzoro, that the individual can consider this a legitimate use of his staka to go beyond necessities and to account for what is going to help the person's emotional state. And then to go further and to say not only is it legitimate, but it's an obligation. So that obligation we can't assign to any one individual because that's not reasonable or practically feasible. But to the tzibor we can assign that obligation. To the tzibor we can say that you have to take care of this. So perhaps that's a way to see this all within such a structure. It's also noteworthy, practically speaking, this is something that's very relevant for rabbis. Rabbis do this all the time. So what else does the Rambam write? That assuming that the individual is not in a position to actually provide the day machzor of somebody who's asking. So what does the Rambam say that you have to do instead?
Tell people.
Modia tsaro l'rabim. Right? So this comes up practically all the time. Again, if you're going to the Rabbanis, so you have this all the time. Right? That one of the things rabbis are called upon to do is to write letters on behalf of people and to tell the world that this individual is a needy person of justified attention. If you look in the Sefer Paris Yosef HaChadash, the Paris Yosef is a beautiful Sefer in general. I don't know if we've mentioned him so far this semester, but the Paris Yosef was an earlier Sefer about 100 years ago on Chumash, on the first three Chumashim up to Vayikra, written by Yosef Patsanovsky. And it's a fascinating likut. He has things there relevant to halacha, to drush, to stories, to lumdus, all kinds of fascinating things, really very enjoyable readings in his mirrors. He has a rhyming introduction. There's all kinds of fascinating things, very worthwhile, enjoyable reading, but only up to Vayikra. So there is a very, very prolific contemporary machaber named Rabbi David Mandelbaum, who's written an unbelievable amount of things. So one of the things that he wrote was a sefer called the Paris Yosef HaChadash, that he basically took on the style of the Paris Yosef, and he wrote on Bamidbar and Dvar. So he reissued the first three volumes in an expanded edition, and now it's two volumes for Bereishis, two volumes for Shmos, two volumes for Vayikra, and it's good to mention this while this farm sale is on, so you can, that's a very nice set to have. And he came out with his own Bamidbar and Dvar, which was not part of the original. Well, the Paris Yosef HaChadash. So, in the Paris Yosef HaChadash in Parshas Re'eh, on the Pasuk of Dei Machzor, first of all, it's worth reading because he has a ton on staka there. He's okay, while we're on this Pasuk, I'll write for 20 pages about staka. But then, focusing on Dei Machzor, so again, he quotes from all kinds of different things. So, he quotes from Chassidish sources, so he quotes a bunch of ideas that have different gematrias in the word Dei Machzor, different ways of darshaning the Pasuk. That it's a reference to letters, that you should write letters on behalf of people. Everyone should know that this individual is in need, and that's how you fill Dei Machzor. So that, again, the idea of the letters directs it towards the community. It says, okay, so you, the individual, aren't necessarily going to be the Baal Tzedakah for this person, but you can be somebody who's going to say, listen, the Tzibur as a whole, not necessarily as far as a kupa is concerned, but as far as an aggregate of individuals, we should be worried about this person and do what we can. Okay, so I'm just going to review in a second, but just what's coming up next. So I want to, for the next day or two, probably look at the specific din that came out of this Gemara. We saw there was a couple points about Dei Machzor in specific situations, such as the wedding. There were dinim here about Kedima, Ishu Isha, things like that. There were Gemaras here about the Aniyim who don't want to accept, about the Halva, about the Matana, about Aniyim who shouldn't be accepting, about the Ramai, the Din of Hamavazvez, Ayavazvez, Yoshim Michomesh. So I'd like to look at those one by one over the next few days and fit that in a little bit also to the structure that we saw. It's also the Sugya Halvanas Pnei Chavei Barab, and again, we discussed that a little bit in Parsha Shir last semester, but it's very interesting in the context of sugya. So maybe we'll take a little bit of a poll, see if people want to see the Makoros inside about that. That's very important, daily relevant sugya. But that's our agenda within the staff, and then we'll move on to the other sugyas that we had on our agenda after that. Okay, so just to quickly review what we spoke about, so we saw the Gemara about the Chovas Mechira, tried to figure out how does that coexist in a world with a Bina De Mahsaro. So first of all, just in terms of the distinction about Kan Kodim Giboy, Kan Va'achar Giboy, so we mentioned on the one hand Rashi's interpretation, the person already collected and now Bezdin is trying to take it back from him. The other Rishonim don't really accept that approach. Tosfos says the approach is distinguished between Leket Shikho Peya and Staka, and the Berakas of Rama asks, what's the difference? You have to be an Ani for either, so why should you distinguish? And he makes an important distinction that maybe when it comes to Staka, we're interested in Kedima, so we want to know if we're going to prioritize who to give first, so then we can start invoking this Chovas Mechira, which is not necessarily relevant in the world of Leket Shechu Peya. And then we saw the Rif's position that someone who's just taking from individuals doesn't have this din, but someone's taking from the Kufa does, and that would seem to suggest that De Machsaro is relevant to individuals and not relevant to the public Kufa that has a more objective kind of standard. And we mentioned the other, the fourth and fifth view in the Rishonim, two opposite ways of saying the same distinction, whether it's that you had these items before or after you started collecting from Staka. So then we discussed other approaches to try to reconcile when you say De Machsaro and when you don't say De Machsaro. We talked about the people who were accustomed to a certain style because they were rich, but not people who just took it on their own, or people who had legitimate reasons. We mentioned that shuvah about somebody who took on a car because he needed a job, and then didn't have a job anymore. Keep added that point also about people who need things so that they can get jobs. Of course, that's a major part of De Machsaro. Also, we talked about the distinction of how only having De Machsaro to conceal somebody's poverty as long as it's not known, which Kvetzis mentions. We mentioned also that the Chaim Knievsky and Derech Amunah points out the halacha, the poskim did not accept that distinction. We mentioned also, I think we also didn't mention this time, that the Meiri also has a distinction that he understands De Machsaro specifically being relevant to Pikuach Nefesh, being relevant to things that people might actually die if they don't have because they become so sensitized, as one of the stories in the Gemara indicates. We mentioned also the Rav Avner quoting the Meiri that it's dafka to keep somebody from complaining against God over his lot in life, and that's why the Gemara says it doesn't extend to enriching someone. We mentioned also the distinction of that De Machsaro is not there forever, it's there to help you to adjust to a lower standard of living, and that could also be what the Chovas Mechira is about, because it doesn't say you're not allowed to have any luxuries, it says that we try to move you down one level at a time. And also the idea that this Gemara, and maybe according to one answer, and the Yerushalmi, and maybe Tosfos make a distinction between something which is Hanas HaGuf, where maybe we say De Machsaro, while something which is completely external to you, maybe we would not say De Machsaro. And then we discussed also the distinction that we find in the Poskim, that the Rama says that De Machsaro is only an obligation on the tzibur, not on the individual. Some disagree. The Bach refers to the story of Hillel. The Bra agrees with the Bach. But the Shach and the Rama say that it only applies to the tzibur. Rav Osner says that the Metzias, if anything, has Paskin like the Rama, that it's only applicable to the tzibur. One of the issues they're dealing with is how can this be reconciled with the idea that there's a limit of one-fifth for tzedakah? How is that something that's sustainable if you're giving De Machsaro to people? And then we talked about how, on the one hand, this seems to be the opposite of what we said in the Rif. The Rif was saying De Machsaro applies to the individual and not the tzibur, and here the Rama is saying the opposite. But then we refined it a little bit to say that, no, that's not actually irreconcilable. It could be that it's different usage of the tzibur. The public kupa, yes, that has a very objective standard, but De Machsaro and the tzibur means that all the individuals together have to worry about De Machsaro. And then we distinguished between De Machsaro as a heter, so to speak, and De Machsaro as a chiyuv. That's a chiddush to say that you're allowed to give tzedakah for such luxuries, and it's a bigger chiddush to say that you may be obligated to give De Machsaro for such luxuries. So we can say the individual is subject to the heter of De Machsaro, and the idea that it's a chiyuv, that's only possible when looking at everyone together, because individuals can't be expected to do this just as a matter of mitzias, not as a matter of absolute kind. And that was a point that Rav Osner was making. And then we saw that the Ramah also adds, which also highlights this communal component, that the individual isn't necessarily capable of providing de machzoro, but he can tell others and get other people involved. Modiya tzar l'rabim, as we said, this is one of the major obligations of a rabbi, and that Paris Yosef HaChadosh quotes the various gematrias that see letter writing as the key chiyuv here. And then we considered whether de machzoro aligns more with a v'halachta b'drachah component or v'yahavta recha kamocha component, and we thought maybe, like Ari was saying, that it probably works a little bit better with the v'halachta b'drachah component, and that presumably is an obligation more associated with individuals. The tzibor as a whole is probably directed more by a communal v'yahavta recha kamocha component, and that works well with our lining up of the riff with this whole continuum, that the kupa of stock focuses only on actual needs and v'yahavta recha kamocha component. De machzara was really for individuals, but the obligation of Dei Machzoro, that's for many individuals together, and that's the tzibur that the Ramah speaks about. Okay, we'll stop there in Daven Mincha, and I hope everyone stays warm and safe in this increasingly complicated weather.